38, beginning at verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut up the sea with doors when it brake forth, as if it had issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and break up for it my decreed place, and set bars and doors, and said, Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed. Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days, and caused the dayspring to know his place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth, that the wicked might be shaken out of it? Brothers and sisters, careful consideration was given to the use of the word ultimate this morning, because we know that there's many false and blasphemous doctrines. There's no shortage of them. Some of the most prominent ones, we're well aware of them: the Trinity, the immortality of the soul, belief in devil and demons, the preexistence of Jesus in a personal sense, heaven and hell going at the moment of death. All of these false doctrines and many more are indeed in stark contrast to the Bible truth, and they in effect do declare Yahweh to be a liar and are consequently all blasphemous to his precious word of truth. But the theory of evolution, while certainly falling into this category, is different in some important points from these doctrines, which we hope to show. Most people would point to the publication of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859 as the beginning, as its beginning. But in fact, the idea that men evolved from animals is much older than this. As far back as the 5th century BC, the Greek philosopher Plato wrote the following to his contemporaries, quote, "You gentlemen are mistaken. Man did not evolve from the beasts, but man began equal with the gods." Of course, this is not quite correct. Psalms 8, verse 2 tells us that man was made a little lower than the angels. But the quote serves its purpose as far as showing us the great antiquity of a belief in the man-made theory of evolution. But here is the most obvious and important point in which this theory differs from many false doctrines we alluded to. These other doctrines at least admit of a belief in a supreme being, however misguided they are, whereas evolution absolutely demands a belief that there is no God who created the heavens and the earth with man upon it. We hope to show that this is not the only evil springing forth from this theory. Its insidiousness and the incalculable damage that it has wrought must be included. Make no mistake upon this fundamental point, then. There is no middle ground, there's no gray area between evolutionism and creationism. Upon this point, that creation is the only alternative to evolution, even the evolutionists confess and agree. And indeed, when Darwin reinvigorated the theory, there was this sharp line of demarcation. But amazingly, or perhaps not so amazingly, considering the near universal ignorance of Yahweh's truth, this line has become blurred or even obliterated over the course of time. For the outright atheist or for the wavering agnostic, this does not apply. The theory of evolution has provided them with a means which they have eagerly seized upon to deny the existence of a supreme being and leave them free to live a life free of moral restraints. No, it's the professed Christian of the world to whom we refer, largely because their faith has been founded upon shifting sand, as it were. They have either completely capitulated to a belief in evolution, thereby relegating the Genesis creation account to a mere fable or a myth, not to be taken literally, or they have in some muddled manner attempted to fuse the two. And now, sadly, what we would have thought impossible just 20 years ago has come to pass. This evil theory has begun to take hold within certain elements of the household of faith in the form of theistic evolution, which we'll touch briefly on a little bit later. We now turn our attention to the primary perpetrator of this outrage against the truth, the scientist. And we say scientists and not science because science itself we understand to be in the strictest sense an accumulation of facts. And as such, it will always be found to be in complete agreement with the Bible. In much the same manner in which lay Christians accept the word of their clergy as unadulterated truth without looking into things for themselves, so does the layman on the street accept the teaching of the scientist in the same manner. This fact in itself helps explain the near universal acceptance of evolution that we see in today's world. But will this theory stand up to the true scrutiny, a true scrutiny from all angles, both scientific and religious? We know that it will not. From a scientific standpoint, we'll look at the three main branches from which this theory has been formulated: archaeology, geography, and biology. First, archaeology. This branch of science, when the finds have any bearing on Bible matters, has fully confirmed the scriptural records. The flood, the fall of Jericho, and the conquest of Canaan are prominent examples. Never once have these stony records invalidated the scriptures in any manner. But when we come to the reconstructed ape man, we find that he is spared the humiliating attacks that skeptics to which God's precious word is subjected. The reason for this is that evolution is in harmony with man's rebellious inclinations. With that said, even scientists are now agreed that at least one of the half dozen or so major finds that constitute the pillars of this false theory was based upon a fake. We refer to the so-called Piltdown Man. This famous so-called missing link consisted, by the way, of the following: 2 small pieces of a skull bone, 1 piece of a jawbone, 1 canine tooth, and 1 small bone. Later investigation proved conclusively that the tooth and the jawbone were deliberate fakes. Similarly, the Java Man, the Neanderthal Man, and the Pekin China find consisted of ludicrously incomplete skeletal remains or fragments. The Pekin Man was actually constructed from pieces scattered as far as 50 feet from each other, discovered over a 2-year period. Even the highly trumpeted 1994 discovery of what they named at the time Lucy, a female hominin — we'll leave out whatever a hominin is — this was discovered in Ethiopia, supposedly a small human about 3.5 feet tall. And this was far from a complete skeletal remain as also. Now, just within the last 2 weeks, there's been a recent update on this subject, and some of you who have looked at the news may have seen it. And that is the discovery of another so-called hominid, quote unquote. It was discovered on the island of Luzon in the Philippines. And here's what they dug up, and this, as I said, is quite recent. 1 hand, 1 foot, 1 thigh bone, and 7 teeth. All of these are well scattered, but I'll give them credit for one thing. Their imagination and these drawings they come up with are really a work of art. Not the complete skeletal remains have not been found. Indeed, they have. But evolutionists are strangely shy of whole skeletons. What's the reason for this? Well, whole skeletons leave no room for the imagination that their theory requires. And more important, they give it absolutely no support. So we see that archaeology pronounces a resounding no to evolution while confirming in every way the veracity of the Genesis account and of the complete scriptural record. We turn next to a consideration of geology. First, let us point be made very clear that we have no quarrel with the basic concept of the great antiquity of the earth. And when we begin to consider a little later what the Bible has to say about this, it will be clear that there are no difficulties, conflicts, or inconsistencies at all. At the very core of the evolutionary theory is the contention that transmutation, or the gradual mutation or evolving of species, has taken place on a vast scale over millions of years. Well, if this were true, we would expect to find a vast amount of fossil remains in this transitional state. But it is a fact, a devastatingly damaging fact to their theory, that every fossil found in a sufficient state of preservation to establish its identity is always, without exception, a fully developed and distinct species, as Genesis 1 verse 25 declares, after its kind. Even the great proponent himself, Charles Darwin, has this to say on the subject. Quote, "The number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory." This is from the proponent of evolution. This quote, by the way, is typical of the uncertain, almost apologetic tone which permeates his entire work, for anyone that ever taken the time to read it. A fair sample of these monotonously recurring phrases in this book are as follows. This is from Origin of Species. "Probably, we may infer, might, may perhaps, I can form no decided opinion, I am doubtfully inclined to believe, I have assumed. Hence we may suppose, it is necessary to assume," and so on, ad nauseum. What a howl of glee would go up if the evolutionist could find only a few such expressions of uncertainty in the Bible. But he cannot, because they do not exist. Instead, we find authoritative declarations like, "It is written, thus saith the Lord. He spake as one with authority. Not yea and nay, but amen," and many other such declarations. Interestingly, it is a fact that those who followed Darwin and enlarged upon his theory, men such as Huxley and H.G. Wells, these men all but burned Darwin in effigy for his uncertain, doubtful tone that we spoke of earlier. But this, it comes as no surprise, it's nothing more than a manifestation of the deceitful, desperately wicked heart of unenlightened man, hardened by the acceptance of a great lie. It is evident then that geology has failed to show the gradual fossil changes which the evolutionist so ardently desires. For the theory to hold water, we see that the rock strata should be teeming with intermediate forms of life, super animals, sub-men, fossil specimens in all ages of transitional development, but there are none. Or, in Darwin's own words, we meet with no such evidence, and this is the most obvious and plausible of the many objections which may be urged against my theory. That's amazing. And this is from the modern day founder of the theory. Lastly, on the subject of geology, there's a gap. There's a gap which is the evolutionist's nightmare. We refer to the gap that exists between the highest form of animal life and the lowest form of human life. Again, we cannot do better than to quote the great advocate of evolution himself. Quote, "There's a great break in the organic chain between man and his nearest allies, which cannot be bridged over by any extinct or living species." This brings us to a consideration of the last of the three branches of science which proponents of evolution use to support their theory, and that's biology. We've all heard the term spontaneous generation, and we recognize in it the evolutionist's reckless speculation as to how life on Earth began. In support of the possibility of this having actually occurred in some remote epoch of the Earth's history, Huxley, Aldous Huxley, advanced his absurd notion of the monkey typist. Some of the older ones amongst us may remember this, and it's probably still widely believed to this day. He says, we quote, "Six monkeys set to strum unintelligently on a typewriter for millions and millions of years would be bound in time to write all the books in the British Museum, the product of blind chance." This is to support his own words where he declares that life began by, quote, "the fusion of a fortuitous concourse of atoms." And this means in plain English one thing, a colossal accident. The monkey typist analogy may sound credible on the surface, but let's examine the odds involved more closely. First, let it be noted that the difficulties would be immeasurably increased were we to insist on correct spacing, capitals, stops, etc. But even waiving these complicating details and allowing the monkeys to type 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at incredible speed, we still arrive at the following statement of mathematical fact. One, the number of possible arrangements of the 26 letters in our alphabet yields a figure which is 27 digits long. If you think that's something, listen to this one. Two, taking at random a sentence from a well-known work of Shakespeare, quote, "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears, I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him," end quote. There are 68 letters in this sentence. Dispensing with the possible combinations and proceeding directly to the heart of the matter, that being how many years it would take the monkeys to type this sentence, we arrive at a figure which is 82 digits long. 82 digits long. Again, this is in years, and it applies to one sentence. Of course, this figure fantastically exceeds anything that has ever been claimed as the Earth's age. All the books in the British Museum, Mr. Huxley? But the problems of a belief in spontaneous generation are deeper and much more profound than this. Obviously, life has never been produced in any laboratory from non-life, and it never will, despite the ongoing fruitless efforts of scientists. Nevertheless, the evolutionists' claim is that protozoa, which is the simplest form of life known consisting of one cell, is the link between inorganic and organic substance. They allege that protozoa generated spontaneously and thus gave the start to life on Earth. The claim at the time, which has since been entirely disproved, was that this was possible due to the extreme simplicity and the supposed lack of structure of a protozoa. As to simplicity, we now know that the cell, the unit of every organism, has a structure compared to which that of a watch is simple and clumsy. There is undeniably intelligent design in the amoeba's ability to eat, to locomote itself in search of food, to grow, and to propagate. Yet another insurmountable difficulty to their theory is the impossibility of life springing forth from a perfectly sterile environment. Years ago, Louis Pasteur first demonstrated the fact that by heating liquids, you destroy in them every vestige of life. Yet, according to geologists, Earth at this early stage of its existence was an incandescent mass which has since cooled down. Since no life known to science can live in such extreme heat, it follows that this Earth was once completely void of life and unable to spontaneously generate life. Simple logic, then, demands that the teeming life which fills the Earth, the sky, and the sea around us today originated from an outside agency. We, of course, know that this agency is Yahweh. Incredibly, the notion has since been advanced that, quote, "protoplasm already formed and living floated to Earth from some other planet." But all that this nonsensical speculation has done is to transport the difficulty to the other planet. No, the unassailable truth is that life is produced by life and only by life. We touched earlier on the subject of geology failing to provide any evidence of the transmutation of species, and we find this to be true in the case of biology as well. Species can be crossbred and they can produce hybrids, as we know, of which a mule is a prime example. Unfortunately for evolutionists, mules are sterile, as are all hybrids. The mule's inherited characteristics, which according to evolutionists should be handed down to its offspring, they never get outside of itself. They die with the mule. Man, by manipulation, can produce slight variations and mutations, neither of which of these can be perpetuated. Simply put, a change of species never has and never can occur. The foregoing scientific analysis has primarily dealt with the founding fathers of evolution, but before examining what the Bible declares on the subject, we would like to establish this point. Evolution has come a long way since the early days, when many objections were raised, and acceptance of it was far from universal. That's not the case today. Today we see it as an accepted fact taught in our schools. To question it and or to declare a belief in creation is to invite outright derision, or at the very best, a condescending smile. To show that their view has not changed, we would like to quote one more short quote from a sentence from a recent National Geographic article about the frantic efforts to find life of any kind on any celestial body, be it asteroid, moon, or planet. Quote, some 4 billion years ago, one hypothesis goes, the chaotic chemistry at the ocean floor provided the fuel for Earth's first organisms. And the same formula may have occurred deep beneath Titan's vast underground oceans. Just some more than nonsensical speculation. Well, that's enough on that. Now, let's turn to our Bibles and read, if you would, Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. The best explanation that I've ever read in any of our pioneer writers about the creation week is in Elpis Israel. I'm going to read just a few sentences. It's not too lengthy, but it's just so well put and so well said about what we're getting ready to elaborate more on. So if you would, we're going to read from Elpis Israel on page 10. And again, these are just some brief excerpts. Let the reader peruse the history of the creation as a revelation to himself as an inhabitant of the earth. It informs him of the order in which the things narrated would have developed themselves to his view had he be placed on some projecting rock, the spectator of the events detailed. This is so important that we get a grip on this. The Mosaic account is a revelation to man, a constituent of the terrestrial system. This will explain why light is said to have been created 4 days before the sun, the moon, and the stars. To an observer on the earth, this was the order of their appearance. Underline, order of their appearance. And in relation to him, it was a primary creation. Though absolutely pre-existent for millions of years or ages before the Adamic era. The duration of the earth's revolutions around the sun, previous to the work of the first day, is not revealed, but the evidences produced by the strata of our globe show that the period was long continued. Fragments of the wreck of this pre-Adamic world have been brought to light by geographical research. Its organic remains, coal fields, strata, belong to the ages before the formation of man. That's a key sentence. Rather than to the era of the creation or the Noahic flood. This view of the matter will remove a host of difficulties which have hitherto disturbed the harmony between the conclusions of geologists and the mosaic account of the physical constitution of our globe. Just a few more sentences. In the period between the wreck of the globe and the epoch of the first day, the earth was as described in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, without form and void, and darkness upon the face of the deep. A globe of mineral structure, submerged in water and mantled in impenetrable night. Out of these crude materials, a new habitation was constructed and adapted to the abode of new races of living creatures. Brothers and sisters, we stated at the start that true science and the Bible is always in agreement. There's no need for Christadelphians to be backed into a corner by claiming that the universe, including the earth, was created 6,000 years ago. True, the references to the pre-Adamic dispensation in the Bible are subtle, they're indirect, and they're entirely contained within the first two chapters of Genesis, which we'll look at these shortly. We must discern the truth concerning these ages before the formation of man, in Brother Thomas's words. This starts by recognizing that Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, is a statement of the primal creation, not the Adamic, and that the millions of years that elapsed between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, and that millions of years did elapse. We've already shown that evolution formed no part of this long time period. Whatever life, plant or animal, that existed then was destroyed in the process of the earth being reduced to the state described in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. And here's what we're just going to briefly make mention of the latest fallacy being advanced, namely theistic evolution. This is within Christadelphian circles. This theory is an attempt to recognize this pre-Adamic dispensation, allowing for evolution to have occurred during it, while at the same time proclaiming a belief in the Adamic creation, as described in the first two chapters of Genesis. In effect, what this theory says is that, yes, evolution did occur, but God was in control. And to think that this includes man himself is a terrible, terrible mistake. What are the indications then in Genesis chapters 1 and 2 of a pre-Adamic dispensation? The first is in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. We just read the verse. In the English word was here, and the earth was without form and void. It is the Hebrew word haya, H-A-Y-A-H. And according to Strong's, it means to be, but it can just as properly mean to become or come to pass. We have a real good proof of this in the fact that the exact same word is used in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. Let's look over there. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became, emphasis became, a living soul. Thus, Genesis 1:2 could just as well be read, and the earth became without form and void. A strong indication that, as a heavenly body, it had been in existence ever since its primal creation, as verse 1 we mentioned. Next, let's look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 22. Here's another subtle indication. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas and let fowl multiply in the earth. The Hebrew word fill here is maleh, M-A-L-E-H, maleh. And according to Strong's, it means to fill or to refill. Here again, we have proof in the exact same word is found in Genesis 1, verse 28. Genesis 1, verse 28, and God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Here the word is translated replenish, which is a word synonymous with refill. The two verses indicate that Yahweh's command was to refill the earth, the sea, and the sky with the beautiful creation that we see around us of life. This would require that the Adamic creation was preceded by a dispensation, which we've termed the pre-Adamic, in which life thrived in earth, sea, and sky. And of course, this is all confirmed by the archaeological record. Truthfully, the pre-Adamic dispensation is of no real importance to us. Our concern is with the Adamic, with which the Bible concerns itself. And were it not for the pernicious theory of evolution, we really should have no cause to delve much into it. But the theory does exist, and so we must be very clear on the points brought forth in this exhortation in order to refute it. I'd like to close by looking at some verses which remind us why, just exactly why this theory of evolution is so prevalent in the world today. First one is Job chapter 21 and verse 14. Job 21:14. Therefore they say unto God, depart from us, for we desire not the knowledge of thy ways. Next is Psalm 12 and verse 4. Psalm 12, verse 4, who have said, with our tongue will we prevail. Our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us? And a memory verse, Jeremiah 17, verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? We move over to the New Testament, and we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 14. 'But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him. Neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned.' Also, 1 Corinthians 3:19. We're familiar with this one. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 11. And for this cause God shall send them a strong delusion, that they should believe a lie. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and they shall be turned to fables, of which evolution is a chief one. And finally, Paul's exhortation to us in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 14. Ephesians 4:14, that we henceforth be no more children, tossed to and fro, and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of man, and cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive. Thank you. The Orlando Ecclesia's basis of fellowship is exclusively the unamended statement of faith, including the commandments of Christ and the doctrines to be rejected. We'll continue with the memorial portion of our service with the singing of hymn number 101. Hymn 101. How few receive with cordial faith the tidings which we bring. How few have seen the arm revealed of heaven's anointed King.